brand new Cavaliers. Kobe Altman, their general manager, is here at the Garden watching as James turns, shoots a three and hits it again. Holsters his right hand as the Cavs go up 10. LeBron James slowing things down, using a Thompson screen. Floats it for Tristan, who grabs it and flushes. J.R. Smith will work it into the front court against Ogilvy on the right wing. How about Cleveland up 20? Here's a three-pointer. Hood making a 23-point game, and all the new Cavs are delivering. James watching the traffic beneath them from on top. Drives, kicks in the corner. Here's Clarkson, another triple, and he hits again. Jordan Clarkson for three. Timeout Boston, and they erupt off the Cavaliers bench, including Kevin Love, who's injured in a suit and delivering handshakes and smiles all around. Down court, Clarkson turns, shoots a three, and hits that one as well. What a debut for Jordan Clarkson. The Cavaliers will dribble out the clock here. Four new members of the Cleveland Cavaliers, three of them scoring double figures, and the Celtics fall here at home to the new-look Cavaliers.
Attention to details tonight was at all-time high for the first time this season. We got some players that can go out and get their own. That's pretty smart. And they picked it up. Like, they've been here all year. It's still going to take a little time, even though this was an impressive win on the road. That's a good start. I think the IQ and the passion that they play with is going to help us out a lot.
I can share a conversation I had with J.R. Smith tonight, and I was talking to him about, like, hey, J.R., you realize that just you, Kevin, Tristan, and LeBron are the only remaining members of this team that won the championship in 2016. And he said, yeah, it's funny. We were on the plane flying out here, and I kind of had that same conversation with LeBron. And LeBron said, who cares? We got a blank word squad now. Even though publicly he has been reserved about celebrating too much about these trades because, yes, it could still go poorly, and two, he doesn't want to really, as he said, throw shade at the guys on their way out the door. There's a little scene behind the scenes where LeBron's legitimately energized and excited about this thing.
They're much better constructed with the youth athleticism, additional three-point shooting. Today, there was a much better resolve defensively. The defensive component is what you're unsure about, but the offense, the athleticism, and the youth, it's real, and it was a terrific job done by the Cavaliers and Kobe Altman.
Yeah, our defense stinks. It starts with tonight that we couldn't stop the ball at all. I mean, we just got broken down, broken down, broken down. We can't guard anybody off the dribble. I thought the new guys played well, and if you look at the plus-minus, that wasn't a problem. It was our starters, you know, other than Andre. Those guys didn't. Just had tough nights.
I'm not trying to cast any direct aspersions on Johnny Manziel. If he says he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, I believe him. My issue is not that. My issue is that every time somebody has a problem, there has to be some medical condition attached to it. Is that always the case? Can you not just be a bad person? Can you not just be irresponsible? Can you not just be egotistical? There's always some type of damn medical explanation. I'm saying that's why you were partying. That's why you were drinking. That's why you were, you know, chasing honeys and not studying the playbook and didn't give a damn about anything but game day. Really? That's the reason? And I'll tell you exactly who I blame for it. Oprah! It's all her fault!
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo's sports leader. My, oh my, how things can change in the span of a trading deadline period. Hoo-wee. Anybody who saw that coming with the old Cavaliers squad, what they did yesterday to the Boston Celtics on national television, what you might call Sunday primetime. On Sundays, I guess 3:30 is primetime, right?
That's what it seems to be, yeah.
Yeah, I would think that's the case. They wanted as many people as they could find to watch maybe the top two teams in the Eastern Conference. Boston, the number one seed. Cleveland, the three-time defending conference champions. Everybody wanted to see that game. Well, everybody wanted to see that game since Thursday, because going into Thursday, which I believe was traded. Was that the trade deadline day? It was Thursday, right?
Yep, right at the top of our show on Thursday.
Going into Thursday, nobody probably wanted to see that game because every time the Cavaliers were on national television, they got drilled, and it was not even competitive or fun or exciting. It was boring. It was lame. Since Thursday and the jettisoning of six Cavaliers who were underachieving or who were bad attitudes, or who were underachieving with bad attitudes, with the exception maybe of Channing Frye, who seems to be a pretty good dude. Everybody else jettisoned from the squad. Four new players brought in. An injection of youth, an injection of vitality, an injection of positivity, and yes, hope for the team that was hoping to make it back to its fourth finals in a row. Yeah, you get that in. Now everybody did want to see that game yesterday. The problem is what they got wasn't very much fun either, because in this case, this particular time, it was still a blowout, but just in the other direction. 49 points, combination of 49 points for the four newest Cavaliers, which of course would be Jordan Clarkson, George Hill, Larry Nance Jr., and blah, blah, blah. Who am I missing, Kush, for crying out loud?
Let's see, you said Nance.
Oh, no, it was Rodney Hood.
Okay.
So, yeah, combined 49 points for those guys. Larry Nance Jr. only had five of them, so the number could have been a lot more impressive sounding than it was, but let's give the kid and the guys time to get themselves acclimated. And I got to tell you, and you just heard most of that at the top of the hour montage there. You heard a lot of the highlights from the Cavs win over the Celtics. You heard some analysis from LeBron and Dave McMenamin, and then a little bit on from Jeff Van Gundy, too, and then a little bit from Stan Van Gundy, the brother, on the Piston struggles. And we'll get back to some of those things in a bit. But for now, let's focus on what we just saw and heard and witnessed from the Cavaliers. This is very interesting now. I don't think there's any question. It's one game, so please bear with me. If they go out and have a stinker as they find chemistry and Ty Lue, who has to, in very short order here, figure out what the rotation is going to be that works best. If there will indeed be a single rotation that works best, maybe it will be multiple rotations based upon opponents that work best, because there are so many new moving parts to this this body, if you will. You know, if we can paraphrase it, it's a body, and there's new arms and there's new legs, and they all have to figure out how to work together here. LeBron James is still the beating heart of the Cavaliers, but what about all these other parts? And what's interesting, while Ty Lue has to figure out how many minutes does Larry Nance Jr. get, how many minutes does Rodney Hood get, how many minutes does Chetty Osmond get, who started yesterday, how many minutes does and infamously flamed on a dunk attempt on a breakaway on a steal. How many minutes does Kyle Korver, you know, some of the holdover guys, how many minutes does he get, and in what order? Who comes off of the bench? Who starts? All of these things, I just feel like what we're about to go through, Cushlin, is, you know, November all over again. Late October and November all over again. They started the season a little bit earlier this year, of course. But I feel like they're about to go through the whole let's figure it out thing all over again, as if they have just broken training camp and preseason basketball, because there's so many new parts. Ty Lue has to figure out who plays well together. It's not like they just brought four guys in from one other team where they already know each other and it's just a matter of, let's say, LeBron getting used to them. But no, these guys come from the Lakers and they come from Utah. You know, when you mix guys in from other places with existing parts, there's who plays well together. Does Rodney Hood function better with Larry Nance Jr.? Does George Hill play better when he's got Jordan Clarkson in the game? Or would it be better to have Clarkson come off of the bench and then have the backup point guard in? I mean, there's so many different elements to all of this that Ty Lue has got to figure out. And I have to believe, despite the one-game-in analysis that this is perfect. They're going to be the Eastern Conference champions, no doubt now. And that's what everybody's saying, by the way. Oh, my gosh. Clearly, they're now better than Boston and Toronto and Washington and anybody else that might be a threat in the East, because we've seen them play one time. It's very easy to do that, but in all truthfulness, you have to believe there are going to be some mistakes. There are going to be some growing pains. There are going to be some where it's like, they didn't look like that 2 days ago. You know, the next time they play, there may be a dud, and people might be going, oh, my gosh, you know, Hill went 1-for-7, and Nance Jr. only scored 4 points again, and whatever the case might be. Ty Lue is going to have to figure out in very short order how to use all of these guys. And then once they get the rotation figured out, about 5 weeks from now, maybe 4.5, I'm trying to remember, going back retroactively to when Kevin Love broke his hand, their rotation is going to change again. Because Kevin Love, who, by the way, should be in the All-Star game, he made the All-Star team but can't play because of it, yeah, he's going to come back to his starting role. Make no mistake about that. That is going to put guys on the bench, and that is going to change the dynamic of the rotation again. So, Jim, I feel like it's Groundhog Day in some ways. I'm repeating, in many ways, the same thing that I repeated at the beginning of the year, saying that Ty Lue is going to have to figure out how to use all these new guys together. He's going to figure out how to use Dwayne Wade with Jose Calderon, with Derrick Rose, with Jay Crowder. He's going to have to find a way to fit all these guys in with the existing Cavaliers, figure out what rotation works. Then, once he figures it out, Isaiah Thomas is going to come back. And then they're going to have to figure it out again because he's going to start. And all those other guys are going to have to be moved. And as we saw, that was a disaster. I mean, it was a little bit of a disaster before Isaiah Thomas came back, but it was full-on meltdown disaster when Isaiah Thomas came back and started playing every day. He was terrible. The rotation didn't work. Defense didn't work. And, you know, they had to blow it up. So I feel like it's a little bit of deja vu all over again here because we're saying they're going to figure out this rotation with all these new guys now, and then in a little while, Kevin Love is going to come back before the playoffs. And then they're going to have to change the rotation all over again. And the question is will they be able to work that, Kush?
Yeah, and that's definitely an interesting analogy, and it really does kind of fit right down to the injured, in theory, star player who will be back later kind of thing. And you're right, there's going to be a feeling out period. It was definitely an encouraging sign yesterday, the way they played, specifically because it was against Kyrie and the Celtics in Boston to boot. But yeah, it's going to take time. There's going to be some slip-ups along the way. Maybe the next time out against OKC and Paul George and them and Russell Westbrook might be one of those. That's a road game after all. It's not going to be easy, despite the positive signs I think we saw yesterday.
Yeah, and I should probably point out that there is one difference between the two different scenarios that I just compared to one another, and that is their positions. When Isaiah Thomas came back, as we knew, things were going to change because he's the point guard. And that changes ball distribution, the way that offenses run, how they use LeBron James, and so on and so forth. When the new version of this happens and Kevin Love comes back off of the injured list and is ready to play and start, he's not a point guard. He is a four. In some cases, he is a five. And I don't like that, by the way. I think he should stay at four. But he has shown a remarkable ability to be selfless and to adapt to a number of different scenarios since he came to the Cavaliers in not demanding the ball. He is not ball dominant the way Isaiah Thomas is and needs to be good. He is a guy who deferred to LeBron and to Kyrie and was accepted being the third option, even though it took him a while to, quote, fit in. And LeBron James, of course, famously told him about fitting out, try fitting in. But Kevin Love is a little bit more, you know, adaptable to new circumstances, I suppose, than Isaiah Thomas was when he came back. So that's a big difference.
No, and you're right about that. And for the record, looking at what they trotted out yesterday, the smart money seems to be on he'd be taking Osmond's place, and he wouldn't have to play five because I think Tristan Thompson would stay the starting five in that scenario. That's probably the lineup change, FYI.
Yeah, and again, I don't know what that, you know, is it going to be an 8-man rotation when it comes down to it? Is it going to be a 9-man rotation? How deep can he go? Because this team is suddenly much deeper. We can't just ignore Kyle Korver.
No.
And the offense he brings. Remember when he played in that game against Atlanta before the new guys got cleared to play? When he played against Atlanta, was it Friday night, I think it was? He threw in a season high 30.
Yep.
And was red hot. He is still a very valuable contributor. J.R. Smith. You know, I can't just say this is like new blood for JR in that he's just now kind of coming around, that the new guys are here, because I think he started to find it a little bit more over the last week or two. But now that they are here and we just look at the box score, JR Smith is still a valuable contributor, or is becoming once again the valuable contributor that he once was. He's only averaging 8 points a game on the season, and that's, like, horrible. But looking at four of his last five games, J.R. Smith is starting to find a little bit of a rhythm, a little bit of a confidence into taking more shots. Going back to the last five games, he scored 12 points with 7 rebounds against the Rockets in that blowout loss on February 3rd. Then he scored 12 on 4 of 6 shooting against Orlando in that embarrassing comeback loss. Then in the win over Minnesota, 140 to 138, he was dynamic. He had 20 points and 3 rebounds and an assist on 7 out of 14, 6 out of 11 from 3. Then a very quiet game against Atlanta in which, again, Korver and other guys went off. He had 7 points there, but then yesterday in the win over Boston, he was 6 out of 7 and 3 out of 4 from 3 for 15 points with 6 rebounds. And you might say, well, those are modest. Yeah, those are modest, but 12, 12, 20, and 15 in those 4 games out of 5 are a hell of a lot better than the 7 points he has been scoring with a gun-shy demeanor that completely belies his career. His career and his reputation and his MO, particularly since he's been a Cavalier, has been to be a, you know, a completely, what's the opposite of gun shy? A gunslinger,
yeah.
Right? He's a gunslinger.
Shooting weird angle shots to boot. Yeah, that kind of thing.
And his best shots are with somebody in his face. You know, he's draining threes on people.
Falling the wrong way, stuff like that.
Falling the wrong way, that's exactly right. But this year he has been gun shy instead. But I'm seeing and have seen for the last week or so, maybe week or two, some signs of him breaking out of that shell. So my point to all of that is Jordan Clarkson going to start taking a ton of minutes away from J.R. Smith? How does Ty Lue massage that situation if J.R. is starting to find himself again?
You know,
is Jordan Clarkson going to play alongside George Hill? Is he going to back him up at the point guard position? How does he massage that situation?
No.
Chetty Osmond, of course, started yesterday. Is that going to continue? I mean, so there's just so many different facets to this. But I have to say this, Jim, if you can hear it in my voice, at least these questions and these scenarios are now exciting. I was literally done.
No, I'm with you. I see where you're going with this. Good call.
Cavaliers on this show. I've been bored by it. Now it's at least exciting. Go ahead.
For me, it wasn't bored so much as getting a little infuriated by it. And at least the questions we can ask now are somewhat, as you pointed out, positive questions. As for the couple of things you're thinking of right there, for JR, it's not just the shell you're talking about. Let's never forget how streaky this guy is. There, even just in his time as a Cavalier, even when he's been gunslinging, he always seems to have those weeks where he just can't hit water if he fell out of a boat, and weeks where he's hitting every crazy falling the wrong way type of shot, or so it seems. So coming out of his shell seems to be coinciding with him in one of those possible hot streaks, which of course helps too. As for the rotation,
and yeah, but if I may, hold on before you go on the rotation. The thing with JR, what makes him so interesting though, is his hot streaks or cold streaks never affected his mentality. He was going to keep firing all the time because he knows as a shooter, the best way to get out of a slump is to what? Keep shooting. That's always been his MO. And this season, what made him different is the shot attempts. The shot attempts in which he has not been shooting. He has decided he to not take as many. And whether it's because he's off or whatever the case might be. And it hurt. That long-range dimension hurt the Cavaliers in their first iteration with the old guys who are gone now. And I think the new / old JR, meaning the JR of his career where he's been a complete gunslinger, I think needs to come back into form here. And over the last 5 games, his field goal percentage is up to 53% over those last 5 games that I just talked about, compared to the low mid-30s that he has been shooting at for most of the season. So that hasn't affected his shot attempts in the past. I think it did this year, and maybe he's breaking out of that.
And that's a good point. There did feel like something extra was wrong, and it just wasn't just a cold streak this year for JR. But to me, the rotation thing is a fascinating question, particularly when Love comes back in, what is it, February 12th. So we're looking at probably about a month and a half or so from now, probably end of March. He'll get those handful of April games is kind of what I'm thinking to get his legs back under for the playoffs. At that point, it's weird to me. I'm looking at it, and I think they have to go 10 deep. And here's what I mean by that. You're probably going to, starting lineup-wise, what we saw yesterday, you're probably going to swap out Osmond for Kevin Love. And I think the other four will stay. But for various reasons, you'll see Clarkson, you'll see Hood, you'll see Larry Nance Jr., because they need the extra bigger guy at times. But then you mentioned Korver, another guy I don't think should be taken out of the rotation. I don't want to see Osmond taken out necessarily either, the way he's going these last couple games. But another player I don't think you can take out of the rotation is one of the few Cavs this season through all the chaos that you haven't had to say much bad about, Jeff Green.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, Jeff Green. And right there, that's 10 guys, if you were doing your math at home, that all deserve minutes at this point.
He is averaging about 20 minutes a game, Jeff Green is. And you're right. On the season, he's averaging 22 minutes a game. Okay. And that, to me, is just about right. You know, he's not a 30-plus minute guy, and he certainly needs a lot more than 10 or 15 that you might give to a less qualified, less productive reserve. I agree. He needs to have a spot in that rotation. But again, Jim, there aren't many teams in the NBA that go 10 deep.
I know.
You know, particularly when you get into the playoffs and guys like LeBron are going to start playing 44 minutes instead of, you know the resting type of minute allocation that he's given in the regular season. And there hasn't been much of that, by the way. He has played a lot more, I think, than a lot of people expected this season. LeBron James, in his now 33 years and his 15th year in the league, is averaging
He's at 37 minutes a game.
37 minutes a game. So that number will go up, obviously, in the playoff rotation. So when you start getting in the playoff rotation and the bench shrinks a little bit and the rotation shrinks a little bit, then it's going to be really, really difficult to see how Ty Lue allocates playing time. Because you've got 3 point guards now. You've got George Hill, who's a point guard, who, by the way, is a very good two-way point guard. He is a very good defensive point guard, and that's something they were lacking when Isaiah Thomas was in. Quite frankly, that's something they were lacking when Kyrie Irving, you know, who could be a great defender when he wanted to be, but was not on a consistent basis because he chose not to be. So George Hill is a very, very valuable player there. And as I mentioned, Calderon, all he did was, you know, play the point guard position when they won 19 in a row. Jordan Clarkson, who can play the two at 6'5", is also a point guard. So there's 3 point guards. You go to the shooting guard position, and as I mentioned, J.R. Smith is still the guy, the starter there for now, unless Jordan Clarkson takes that position from him. And then you also have Kyle Korver, who's got to be in that rotation because of the instant offense he provides off of the bench as a shooter. At the three, obviously, LeBron is going to take most of the minutes, but that's also where you're going to find Jeff Green. And how do you find him minutes once LeBron starts playing more and more minutes as we get to the playoffs? And even to that push and that rotation starts to shrink down a little bit, Jeff Green might find himself, Kush, on the losing end of that, you know, that equation. There just aren't going to be many minutes at the small forward.
No, position. You're right. He might be reduced to your LeBron's breather guy, as sad as that is.
Then when you get to the power forward position, obviously Kevin Love, when he comes back, that's his position. It's also the same position that Larry Nance plays. Does Larry Nance slide over to the center and play some? If so, how does that affect Tristan Thompson's minutes? Because, quite obviously, Larry Nance Jr., being younger, is also a rebounder like Tristan, but probably has a little bit more ability to put the ball in the basket.
Yep.
On a regular basis than Tristan Thompson does.
And he's going to be the main, that's where I put him in the rotation. He's going to be the main big backup behind Love and Thompson when one of them needs a breather and they swap out things like that.
And then you have two other, you know, it's funny because I sit here and I'm talking about, well, Jeff Green's going to have to be LeBron's breather guy. Really? Well, what's Chetty Osmond then? Because he's also a small forward. And then you say, really? Well, what's Rodney Hood then? He is also, you know, a small forward slash shooting guard. Rodney Hood, 6'8", plays shooting guard and small forward. Where are his minutes coming from if J.R. Smith and Jordan Clarkson are playing most of the two and LeBron is playing most of the three and all Rodney Hood is doing is averaging 16 points a game this season? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Yeah.
This is a very, very convoluted situation that Ty Lue is going to have to manage. He is not only going to have to manage the minutes for all of these guys from the standpoint of who plays well together and how does it work together, he's going to have to manage their egos in terms of who loses minutes and is okay with it and it doesn't become a disruption. And he's also going to have to manage the minutes as far as productivity, because what might be the rotation on Monday night might be very, very differently on Wednesday night, given the fact that they have so much more depth than they did before. Kobe Altman did a remarkable job in restocking a roster of dead pieces and parts and replacing them with productive pieces and parts, and it's all up to Ty Lue to fit that jigsaw puzzle together.
And that's a good call bringing Kobe Altman into this because, you know, given the circumstances, having to take over the way he had to after the, well, the idiocy surrounding David Griffin last summer, I didn't think he I honestly didn't think Kobe Altman would be able to pull this kind of thing off the way he did at the last second. It's always felt like he's had a deer in the headlights kind of look about him so far in his role in this spot.
Yeah, well, if he did, it's not his fault, and it's not really who he is.
Sure.
If he did, it's obviously just because this came about in a very, very odd way. He wasn't expecting this, and perhaps he didn't plan and prepare for it, and it took him a while to kind of get his feet underneath him and figure out what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it. But he has indeed claimed that front office as his own now. And I don't know how much, to be honest with you, Dan Gilbert had to do with any of this. But I'll tell you this. I'm going to praise Dan Gilbert in a way that very few people praise Dan Gilbert. Because either way, he deserves a lot of accolades. Either he got the hell out of the way and let Kobe Altman fix a busted, broken, ego-filled, dysfunctional roster of guys that didn't get along with one another, including LeBron James, by the way, who spent all of his time with his buddy Dwayne Wade and completely ignored everybody else on the roster, according to many people close to the situation. But either Gilbert let Altman do this on his own, which is to be praised, rather than being hands-on, or he was hands-on, and the two of them, you know, found a way to massage this situation and to finish the deals with Utah and with the Lakers and to bring these guys in and to make the move to send Dwayne Wade back to Miami and all the rest. I don't know how much of it is, but Dan Gilbert, whose relationship with LeBron James has always continued to be tenuous since LeBron James' return, may have done some really, really great backroom work in trying to support and grow the talent on this roster enough to make LeBron James either sign long-term at the end of this season or really look bad when he leaves at the end of this season because of what they did for him.
And if it turns out to be the latter, that's the other part to like about some of these moves. They were able to keep the Brooklyn pick, and let's see, I think all but Hood are signed at least through next year, so beyond a possible LeBron leaving again, just as a random eye to the future.
Yeah, no question about that. All right, let's turn our eye to the present right now because it's 3:35, and we need to get a timeout for a bottom-of-the-hour local sports center. By the way, coming up at about 4:40, about an hour from now, a little more, Paul Keel's going to join us about the red-hot Buckeyes
of
Ohio
State. Tops in the Big Ten.
What's that?
Tops in the Big Ten.
How about it? You know, I didn't see it happening. And we kind of talked about how well they've been playing. They won a bunch in a row. They've got a great streak going. And then they had that streak snapped against Penn State. And then they started another one. But, you know, they got Purdue coming. And that's, the number three team in the country at Purdue. That'll kind of cool them off a little bit. Nope. A win in Lafayette, followed by a win at home against Iowa. They've won four in a row now, and the beat goes on for the 22-5 Buckeyes, first in the Big Ten. And if the college season ended, if the season ended and the tournament began right now is what I'm trying to say, where would the Buckeyes be seated? Well, we have an idea. We'll talk about that a little bit as we continue, and Paul Keels will join us as well at 4:40. So we got a bottom of the hour sports center coming up, and then actually prior to that, what do you say we get wild?
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
One of the ice for this wild stat. There were nine games in the NHL yesterday. All nine of them were won by the road teams. The wild stat here is that is the most games in any single day won by road teams in NHL history. That's pretty freaking crazy. Or in our case, it's wild. Buffalo Wild Wings, wild stat of the day. Bottom of the hour sports center coming up. Let's get you involved. Dial up 866-240-1065. Do you believe that the East is now over? Is this new-look Cavaliers team the beast of the East that it was supposed to be with the old guys? Or is this still very, very much in doubt? I want your thoughts on it at 866-240-1065, right here on the Ticket.
Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling right along, it's 3:43. Right here on this Monday afternoon extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. I threw a really, well, I thought it was really interesting question up on our Facebook page earlier today. This morning on Golic and Wingo, and by the way, they had Adnan, whatever his last name is, in for Wingo this morning. And he had to be fined because he called it Mike and Mike. Even I haven't done that yet in referring to it. But on Golic and Golic and Wingo this morning, they were talking about the Winter Olympics and all the, you know, the difficulty of some of the sports. And I've made it very clear on this program, I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of the Winter Olympics because I'm not a fan of most winter sports. I don't ski. I don't skate. I don't luge. I don't bobsled. I don't curl. And I don't, what am I missing? I don't skeleton. I don't snowboard. I don't half pipe. I don't full pipe. I don't ice fish either. When it's winter and there's snow and ice outside, you can usually find me inside. So that's just the way that I feel, and so I'm not a big fan of this stuff. But be that as it may, it was an interesting discussion this morning on Golic and Wingo, in which they talked about, if you could participate in one of these Winter Olympic sports, what would you participate in? And they talked about, you know, the skating or the skiing or whatever, and what everybody's favorite thing was. And again, since I don't have any favorite things there, I kind of stole the question and I created a spinoff of it and just kind of manipulated it a little bit. And I asked this question on our Facebook page a little bit earlier today, which is ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, of course. Just for fun, if you could have one professional sports skill, and Kushlin, you think about this too. If you could have one professional sports skill that you don't currently have, any one, but only one, what would you choose? Would you take the ability to hit a streaking receiver in stride from 75 yards away with that cannon of an arm that you have, like a pro quarterback? Would you rather have the ability to launch baseballs off over a wall 390 feet away from a 100-mile-an-hour fastball? Would you rather have the skill of being able to throw the 100-mile-an-hour fastball? Would you choose to stripe the middle of the fairway with 325-yard bombs off the tee? Would you rather have the skill that allows you to hit threes from 25 feet with ease, a la Steph Curry? Or would you rather be the guy that can fly through the air and dunk from the foul line? Maybe to hit the frozen ropes, passing shots like Roger Federer or Serena Williams, the kind that nobody else can touch? What one professional sports skill, if you could have one, would you rather have if you could magically acquire them? Kushlin, what about you?
You know, for me, and this goes back actually a ways.
Let me throw the number out again, 866-240-1065. Yes. I want to hear what people say. I got a lot of responses on this on my personal page, and not as many on the ESPN 106.5 The Ticket page right now, so I want to see what ticket listeners think. What if you could do one thing and do it great and be professional at it and actually, you know, make a living doing it, would you rather be that guy who can throw the bomb, throw the 100-mile-an-hour fastball, hit the ball, hit that drive down the middle, all those things that I said, or pick something on your own. You can come up with your own choice. Go ahead, Jimmy. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's all right. For me, I've kind of had an answer to this type of question for a long time. For me, it's definitely the baseball one. Although I want to make an addendum. It's not so much the power. I want the ability to be able to spray that ball all over the field, a la Tony Gwynn, Ichiro, Pete Rose, that kind of guy. If I get the occasional home run, cool.
Why?
I don't know why. I love those kind of players. We don't have enough
though.
Of them.
I mean, all right, I slapped a single
through
the hole
between. Oh, it's boring hitting 350. Yeah, I'll take that as boring.
But yeah, but it's boring. I mean, just, yeah, I can flick the bat out there and watch it Wade Boggs style go through the hole between short and third and round to first and trot back in the first where I get wasted and stranded because three other hitters are about to make outs. Understanding this, somebody bring me my gloves so I can go play the field. Or the guy who drives one over the wall. I don't need anybody else to bring me home because I'm coming a-trotting. And I've brought myself home, and I've got the glory of the legions of angels cheering and applauding me. I don't know, because you know what happens when you hit your single cush through the hole? Mr. Tony Gwynn, the dude in the fourth row, says, I'll be right back. I'm going to go get a beer. When I hit my bomb over the wall again, he's on his feet spilling his beer. Ah! You know, I want the glory, bruh. If I'm going to be able to do one of these sports skills, pro skills, I want the glory, not the yawn. Oh, yeah, there's a little single by Boggs. Ichiro just slapped one between, you know, up the middle, and, you know, he's on first, and he'll die there in about 6 minutes.
Now, what's funny, though, is that guy that you said would be bored and going to get his next beer while I'm up to play. Yeah, many, many years later, when I'm getting into the Hall of Fame for being a 330 lifetime hitter, he'll be like, oh, yeah, that I remember him, decent player, very deserved.
Yeah, but they're going to go right past your plaque to mine when it says, you know, 649 career home runs on it. You see, they're going to say, oh, yeah, I remember the shot he hit in the bottom of the eighth at so-and-so. Not the, hey, do you remember that two-out single that he slapped between first and second base in June, in the June 5th game against the Pirates of 1974? No, I don't actually. But I remember the bomb that France hit in the bottom of the eighth in game six of the ALCS to go to the World Series. Come on, man. People don't remember those hits. They remember. Let me ask you. Outside of Pete Rose's career 4192 was the one that passed
Ty Cobb.
Cobb. He had 4191. Cobb had 4191. So outside of that single, Kush, can you name for me a famous single right now? It's just a famous single in baseball lore.
All right, I can't really name a famous single off the top of my head without actually sitting down for a minute and thinking of some big games. You got me there.
Can you name
so
a famous
basically
home
what
run?
We're arguing about, though, is the old chick stick the long ball. Is that
That's
what we're arguing
right
here?
Do I have to talk about the shot heard around the world? Do I have to talk about, you know, Reggie Jackson's three in one game in the 1977 or 78 series? I mean, honestly, we could talk about Hank Aaron's 755th. We could talk, the list of famous home runs goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. Famous singles, even RBI singles to win games. I'm sure there are some. In fact, throughout the history of baseball, there's probably more game winning RBI singles than there are game-winning home runs, I would imagine, throughout the history of this great sport, right? But you can't remember a damn one of them because it was only a single. But you remember the walk-off shot. You remember the bomb. And that's why, for me, I mean, if I was doing the baseball thing, I'll tell you what you just chose, Jim Cushlin, I would choose for as the last thing of all the baseball. I would rather be the guy that drives the 100-mile-an-hour fastball out of the park for that honor that I just mentioned, or I'd rather be the 100-mile-an-hour pitcher that strikes that guy out, that gets that final out, or that throws that no-hitter, or whatever, like Nolan Ryan, one of those guys, rather than just the slap hitter that you want to be. Yeah, you know what? That figures. You are a slappy. Cushlin is a slappy, now, and he wants to be a slap
hitter. Well, here's the other thing, too.
I'm a bomber, and I want to hit the bombs.
Here's the other thing, too. Now this getting this skill in this hypothetical, does that change the fact that I'm 5'4", maybe 5'5", on a good day? No, I'm serious. 5'5", on a good day 10 years ago?
No, I don't know. I don't
then,
suppose you
I'm
have to change your
bombs,
body.
Everyone's just going to assume I'm on the juice, man.
No, I don't think you have to change your body.
And more,
I'm just saying, could you have this skill? You know, there are golfers like John Daly, 6'3", 300 pounds, you know, body by Budweiser, and who hits, you know, 330-yard bombs. And then there are smaller dudes who step to the tee and it's like, ain't no way, this guy's got distance. He must be about accuracy. He must be about hitting fairways, and he can drive it just as far just because of the torque that he creates with the swing. So you don't have to be built like the home run, you know, the bomb hitter. You just have to have the skill. That's what I'm talking
okay,
about.
Okay, fair enough. And a couple other things that jump out at me as I'm having a little fun with this one right now. One, it's interesting, the type of player that I describe, that's how you always want, you know, if you're training your son to play ball, that's how you would want him to play, not swinging for the fences. And two, by this logic, that means it's more exciting and better for you to watch Adam Dunn than it would have been to watch Ichiro. Is that what you're saying?
In the moment of the bomb, yes. In the moment of the bomb, yes. Adam Dunn's bomb will be remembered a lot longer than Ichiro's single up the, you know, down the right field line. He might stretch it into a double. Woo! But yes, it's going to be remembered a lot more. I would rather have the ability to end games with one swing than to continue an inning. There's two outs and I get a two out single and maybe another guy will get a single and another guy and then I'll be able to come around and score. I would rather be able to score on one swing of the bat. Absolutely.
This is very telling, too, because it's this mindset, and it's not just you. I know tons and tons other, and I'm guilty of it at times, too, have this kind of thought process. And this is possibly one of those reasons why all the home run numbers like last year are up and everybody's strikeouts are at totals we've never seen before.
But I want to know why it's because of you. We're just locked in on the baseball thing. Because I'll be honest with you, football is my favorite sport.
Right. Baseball's mine, but that more has to do with the time period where I was coming of age. Browns were about to move, and the Indians were actually good.
And that's fine, but because you know, I just threw these up here for the purpose of the question on our Facebook page. I started out with, you know, throw a football 75 yards to a receiver in stride, hit home runs, stripe the middle of the fairway with 325 yard drives, hit threes, dunk from the foul line, hit frozen ropes in tennis. I was just trying to include other sports. For me. I think my first would probably be the first one that came into my head, which is, you know, to be that quarterback, to be the guy that drops back, evades the rush, and then throws the perfect freaking bomb into the waiting arms of the greatest receiver of all times as he's in stride and wins the Super Bowl. One of those kind of players. I'd rather be Aaron Rodgers more than I would like to be, I don't know, who's a great home run hitter today? Or even Jim Tomey. I'd rather be Aaron Rodgers only because I love football more than baseball. I'd rather be Jerry Rice on the other end of that, by the way, than be, pick a power pitcher who's got that perfect. You know, we don't have to be the best of all time. I just said have a professional skill. Steven Strasburg. You know, I'd rather be, I think I'd probably rather be, I'm just trying to think of a receiver, Antonio Brown. I'd rather be that than be, you know, your 330 hitter or be, Steph Curry, you know, filling it up from beyond the arc. I think I would rather do that. But there's other things that I'm getting on. Let me get a call in here real quick because I don't want to make Jerome wait too much longer. We have a top of the hour sports center coming up. So let me bring Jerome in from Toledo here on the ticket. Hey, Jerome, thanks for calling, brother. What's going on?
Not too much. The hammer.
The Listen. Hammer. All right, hammer. What are you thinking here?
Kush, man, you must be from the same part of Ohio. You're from around Cleveland, right?
Originally, yes.
Okay, I'm from Ravenna, Ohio.
Okay, I know where that is.
Now, I'm like you. I want to be the Ricky Henderson type of player. I want to slap it, maybe hit a home run. I want to steal 70 bases, and I want to be in center field with that rifle to cut you down at home plate.
Ricky Henderson, nice.
That's my type of baseball player. Yeah, we like to see the guy hit the home run, but we like to see you slap that baby, get down to first, steal second, steal third, and when that guy that we want to see hit that home run, when he misses and pops up that long fly, I want to be the one to trot home from third base and win the game.
Here's the thing.
I want to go back out in the field, and when that guy is on third base trying to get home, I want to have that rifle to gun him down.
I don't know that Ricky Henderson ever had that kind of gun, by the way.
You didn't have. Said that's the type of player that
I know.
I would like to be along with Ricky Henderson.
You know what I would choose just to maybe find the best of all worlds between what I'm talking about with the bombs and what you guys are talking about with the, you know, the clutch hit that isn't a bomb but also steal a base and also play tremendous defense. I think what you're saying is you'd like to be Ken Griffey Jr. Ken Griffey Jr., who's going to hit 600 home runs. Ken Griffey Jr., who's going to hit 325, 330. Ken Griffey Jr., who can get that hit up the first baseline and then steal second and steal third. And the guy who can reach over the wall and take the home run away and to save the game in the next half inning. Or gun somebody down at second or third or at the plate. So, to me, if you really want to do that, I want to include my home runs with the kind of guy you're talking about. And I find
we can go with that, and that's why I call you the hammer.
I love it, my man. Thank you, Jerome. God bless
you. Have a good one.
You got it.
Ken Griffey Jr., I like that. That's a good comparison, too.
But I want to read just a couple of these on my Facebook page, Kush.
And, go ahead.
And again, I'd like to get more of these on the Tickets Facebook page. I have my own personal page, but then we have the Ticket one too, and I put it up on both places. A lot of responses on one, not as many on the other, but here's what some people are saying. I'd rather be able to drive. Kirk says I'd rather be able to drive and win the Daytona 500. That kind of skill. Okay. That's not my thing, but I'm with you. Let's see. Richard says, to have my shoulder touched by God, 100-mile-an-hour fastball. That skill. I would like to have that one. That one is probably second to me behind the bombs if I'm doing the baseball thing. But here are some others that I really, really like. Where did it go? Hold on. Here it is. I lost it again. My apologies. Here it is. Michael, to beat the living crap out of someone in under 3 minutes, a la MMA. Somebody wishes they had MMA skills. I got to tell you, if I could only pick one professional sports skill to have, that might be the one, because it would be the one that would be the most useful to you in your non-sports life and after your retirement. You know, if you can fight like that, you and your family, your girlfriend, your wife, your children, whatever, will always be protected. Nobody is ever going to mess with you. That would be an interesting skill to have, because throwing a baseball 100 miles an hour isn't going to help me in life once my career's over. Throwing that touchdown bomb, being able to do any of those things. But if you can kick some A, then you know what? You are safe for the rest of your life, unless, of course, somebody pulls out a gun on you. The other one somebody said is, Gregory says, PGA Tour Pro, to be sure. And that's an interesting thing, too, Kush. If you can swing it and stripe it 325 straight, even if you're not on the Pro Tour anymore, just for the rest of your life, mm-hmm. if you're a golfer, and I know you're not much of a golfer, Jim, but to, you know, people who are weekend golfers like I am, my goodness, you can do that until you're 70.
Yeah.
You know, and just have fun for your entire life with that great skill transferring. Once you're done with your baseball career, if you can throw it 100 miles an hour, it's not going to help you when you play beer league softball.
Right.
You know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
If you can catch, you know, 95 passes a year, it's not going to help you much once your career ends, unless you really like flag football.
Or unless you're Brady, who's going to try to play till 50 or something.
Right, there you go. But if you can golf, if you can hit that thing 325 when you're in your prime, you can still hit it 275 when you're well past your prime and straight. You're having fun taking money off of fools at the golf course
yep.
for the rest of your life.
And not even just the fools on the golf course on a Saturday, Bob. Golf is the only sport I can really think of where there literally is a professional senior citizen circuit.
That's right. So you can be old and keep doing it that way, too. No question about it. All right, just a fun little thing. If you'd like to comment, I'll read more comments, and I'll give you your attribution. I'll tell people your name and where you're from. Answer on our Facebook page. In fact, I may have to throw it on the Twitter feed, too. But if you could pick one professional skill to have, which one would you pick? And thanks to Golic and Wingo this morning for talking about this Olympic style. I was able to adapt my question from that, because I think it's it's just a fun discussion. All right, it's 4:01. Let's get our Top of the Hour Sports Center coming your way next right here on ESPN 106.5.
Well, the brand new Cavaliers, Kobe Altman, their general manager, is here at the Garden watching as James turns, shoots a three and hits it again, holsters his right hand as the Cavs go up 10. LeBron James slowing things down, using a Thompson screen, floats it for Tristan, who grabs it and flushes. J.R. Smith will work it into the front court against Ogilvy on the right wing. How about Cleveland up 20? Here's a three-pointer, Hood making a 23-point game, and all the new Cavs are delivering. James watching the traffic beneath them from on top, drives, kicks in the corner. Here's Clarkson, another triple, and he hits again. Jordan Clarkson for three. Timeout Boston, and they erupt off the Cavaliers bench, including Kevin Love, who's injured in a suit and delivering handshakes and smiles all around. Down court, Clarkson turns, shoots a three, and hits that one as well. What a debut for Jordan Clarkson. The Cavaliers will dribble out the clock here. Four new members of the Cleveland Cavaliers, three of them scoring double figures, and the Celtics fall here at home to the new-look Cavaliers.
Attention details tonight was at all-time high for the first time in the season. We got some players that can go out and get their own. That's pretty smart, and they picked it up like they've been here all year. It's still going to take a little time, even though this was an impressive win on the road. That's a good start. I think the IQ and the passion that they play with is going to help us out a lot.
I can share a conversation I had with J.R. Smith tonight, and I was talking to him about, like, hey, J.R., you realize that just you Kevin, Tristan, and LeBron are the only remaining members of this team that won the championship in 2016. And he said, yeah, it's funny. We were on the plane flying out here, and I kind of had that same conversation with LeBron. And LeBron said, who cares? We got a blank word squad now. Even though publicly he has been reserved about celebrating too much about these trades because, yes, it could still go poorly, and two, he doesn't want to really, as he said, throw shade at the guys on their way out the door. There's a little scene behind the scenes where LeBron's legitimately energized and excited about this thing.
They're much better constructed with the youth athleticism, additional three-point shooting. Today, there was a much better resolve defensively. The defensive component is what you're unsure about, but the offense, the athleticism, and the youth, it's real, and it was a terrific job done by the Cavaliers and Kobe Altman.
Yeah, our defense stinks. Starts with tonight that we couldn't stop the ball at all. I mean, we just got broken down. We can't guard anybody off the dribble. I thought the new guys played well, and if you look at the plus minus, that wasn't a problem. It was our starters, you know, other than Andre. Those guys didn't, just had tough nights.
I'm not trying to cast any direct aspersions on Johnny Manziel. If he says he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, I believe him. My issue is not that. My issue is that every time somebody has a problem, there has to be some medical condition attached to it. Is that always the case? Can you not just be a bad person? Can you not just be irresponsible? Can you not just be egotistical? There's always some type of damn medical explanation. I'm saying that's why you were partying. That's why you were drinking. That's why you were, you know, chasing honeys and not studying the playbook and didn't give a damn about anything but game day. Really? That's the reason? And I'll tell you exactly who I blame for it. Oprah. It's all her fault.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Hour number two underway, 15 minutes after 4 o'clock. Coming up in about 25 or so, we're going to talk Ohio State basketball. What the living hell has gotten into the Buckeyes? Cushlin, this was not supposed to happen.
Nope.
Not this season.
Nope.
Not with a first-year head coach.
Nope.
Not with a young team.
Yep. Nope.
Not with a program essentially in transition. 22-5, and the Buckeyes just beat number 3 Purdue last week before beating Iowa this weekend, and now they've got, four regular season games left.
Yeah.
Penn State, only one of them ranked, that would be number 22, Michigan. Penn State beat them before, by the way.
Yeah, on that final shot.
PSU, Michigan, Rutgers, and Indiana to wrap up the season before the Big Ten tournament, and the Buckeyes should be flying high. They are now in control of the Big Ten, first place in the Big Ten. 13-1 overall. Michigan State and Purdue both 12-2. Nebraska checks in at 10-4. Michigan at 9-5. And the Buckeyes have that impressive 22-5 win. Where would they be if they were starting the NCAA tournament right now? What seed would they be? Right now they're number 8 in this week's AP Top 25. Cushlin, for me, that means the Buckeyes would be no less than 2 seed.
Should be, yeah.
Because, you know, top 8 teams, if the top 4 are your 1 seed, your second 4 should be your 2 seed. So I would think they would be a 2 seed in the NCAAs if they started right now. This is just an amazing run that they're on. And Paul Keels will join us coming up at about 4:40 to break some of that down. I'm going to do the math here, or just count real quick. 2, 4, 6, 8. They had won 8 in a row. So now they have won 12 out of their last 13. Only that last second shot to Penn State that you talked about breaking what would be a 13-game winning streak.
And the only Big Ten losses you mentioned.
And, you know, by the way, 12 out of 13 and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it would be 17 out of their last 19. 17 out of their last 19 for the Buckeyes.
And what's interesting, you mentioned that overall record with 5 losses. Yeah. Most of them came, 4 out of the 5, therefore, came early in the season out of conference. And when you look back at them,
3 in a span of 4 games.
Yeah, I mean, one of those early season tournaments. But if you look at the opponents, they're all acceptable. Lost to Gonzaga, Butler, Clemson, and at North Carolina. Those are all tournament teams right now.
Yeah, that's 4 out of the 5 losses. Only the Penn State one really looks kind of bad.
Yeah.
And again, they have a chance to avenge that literally next, coming up on, when do they go at it again?
That'd be Thursday night, 7:30 coverage time, 8 o'clock tip right here on the Ticket.
So Paul Keels and I will talk about that, and Jim will be talking about that coming up a bit. Just real quick, though, because he put this in, Jim, you put this into the montage,
mm-hmm.
The Johnny Manziel story. You laugh, and I do too, to a degree, but there's something interesting about it. There's something intriguing about it. There's something worth discussing about it, and that is, does a guy deserve a second chance if he is, you know, there's two elements to the Johnny Manziel story. Number one is the fact that Johnny Manziel was a borderline prospect quarterback. I mean, he was a first-round draft pick by the Browns, which may say more about him than it does.
Or he won a Heisman, yeah.
But he was borderline talented enough to play in the league in the first place. But let's just assume for a second that he's over that borderline and he is talented enough to play. The question of second chances and how much, you know, of an opportunity somebody deserves if they have had their come-to-Jesus moment. And then the question of, is this really his come-to-Jesus moment? Or is he just saying the things that he thinks he needs to say? He's not dumb. He's a smart dude. And I think he knows marketing. And I think he knows how to sell himself. He used to sell himself as Johnny Moneyfingers, you know, the party boy. And this was just going to be, hey, let's wreck this league.
Johnny Football.
Johnny Football. And that's his nickname, of course. I just throw the Moneyfingers in there because I think he's as known for that as anything. You know, he sold and marketed himself that way. Let's wreck this league. And now he knows that that sale is over and he's got to sell himself another way. And that is the mature, responsible, recovering alcoholic who's got some bipolar issues, some mental issues that should earn me some of your sympathy and some of your pity if I can't get your respect. And he might just be trying to sell us another bill of goods here, but there's a question of whether or not somebody deserves a second chance. Listen just a little bit to what he said in this exclusive with I believe it was ABC News.
I was self-medicating with alcohol. Like, that's what I thought was making me happy and helped me get out of that depression to a point of where I felt like I had some sense of happiness. But at the end of the day, when you wake up the next day after a night like that or after going on a trip like that, and you wake up the next day and that's all gone, and that liquid courage or that liquid, like, sense of euphoria that's over you is all gone, and you're left staring at the ceiling by yourself, and you're back in that depression and back in that hole, that dark hole of sitting in a room by yourself, being super depressed, thinking about all the mistakes you've made in your life. What did that get me? Where did that get me except out of the NFL? Where did that get me disgrace?
Yeah, it did. It got him disgrace. It did get him out of the NFL. And he is saying that the realization that he found that and figured that out is what should give him another chance to get into the NFL. He was on Good Morning America, was Johnny Manziel. And it was there that he also explained that he has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and is taking medication for it. And he said that he feels motivated to get back to doing what he loves because, quote, I am watching all the other guys doing what I want to be doing, and I'm sitting on the couch being a loser. Which is pretty strong talk. He said the diagnosis came about a year ago of bipolar disorder and that the alcohol was his way of dealing with his bipolar disorder that he didn't even know he had. But now that he does know he's bipolar and that's what caused him to drink so much, he is in a program. He said, at the end of the day, I can't help that my wires are a little bit differently crossed than yours. I can't help my mental makeup of the way that I was created. He said, I know if I stay on these meds and continue to do what I'm doing right now, I think my mom, my dad, my girlfriend would all agree they see a drastic change. End quote. Kush, do you buy drastic change because of a diagnosis of, and bipolar disorder is real. What's interesting, I don't know that he had any proclivity to violence. A lot of times, I'm not trying to be, you know, radio psycho guy. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist or any kind of a mental health expert. When I think off the cuff as a layman of bipolar disorder, I think of people who go from periods of calm to periods of anger and hostility and sometimes violence. I don't know that he necessarily has any proclivity to those things, but be that as it may, he says he's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, he's on medicine, and that it is leading to a drastic change. Do you see a drastic change here, or do you see a guy who'll say whatever it takes to get some general manager to say, oh, well, now that we know what it was, and now that we know he wasn't drinking because he liked to party, be what he's drinking because it was the only way he felt normal, because his wires are crossed a little differently, as he put it. Now let's see, we'll bring him into training camp, and as an invitee and see if he's got anything. And, oh, by the way, it should be pointed out, since he did get a four-game suspension before the end of his career with the Browns, any team that signs him, he would have to serve that four-game suspension. Of course, it probably wouldn't matter. He'd be a backup anyway, but he would have to serve that before he would be eligible to play anyway. Do you buy the story that he's telling right now, Kush, or is this just a way to try to get back into the NFL and he's going to play the pity card as his means of getting back?
There's a reason I played that Stephen A. Smith clip from his show earlier today. I happened to catch him talking about that live, and I decided to then pluck that and play it back for us so we could all hear it, because I'm leaning towards B, okay? It's not to say that...
Is that B followed by an S?
But I'm looking at it and thinking, not to disparage him, not trying to doubt that he does have bipolar, but I think it's more of Colin B trying to say what he can to get back into football. And he's burned enough bridges over time that it's hard to fully buy into that. And as Stephen A. Mentioned in that clip that I played at the top, you know, how should that, you know, should that take away from, you know, being held accountable for doing the things that you did do? For example,
he says no. To be clear, he says no. He says he is taking full responsibility for all of the things he did that cost him his career. And I'm looking for the quote on that. At the end of the day, no, I already read that part. Hold on. Where is this? I can't find it. Oh, here it is. He acknowledged that there's no one to blame except himself after the drinking binges documented on social media and a run-in with the law that included a domestic assault charge. Oh, okay. I forgot about that.
I was just going to bring that up to you, yeah.
When I brought up proclivity to violence, he does have a domestic assault charge. I didn't realize. You were staring at the ceiling by yourself, and as he said, it got me out of the NFL and it got me to disgrace, but he said it is all his fault. So, and that is a part of any 12-step program.
True.
If he is doing a 12-step to get by his alcoholism and his self-medication, as he called it, for the bipolar disorder and the depression. So if he is indeed taking responsibility for himself, then no, it doesn't excuse what he did before, and that probably is something that any general manager would have to decide. Is it sincere? Is
right.
that how he sincerely feels about it? Or is, again, that just what he needs to say in order to have anybody even think about giving him a look?
And that's where I think it falls into both of those categories, because, you know, at this point, it's up to some GM out there if they want to take that stab in the dark that he's for real this time. And what we're hearing is the truthful self-reflection of somebody who has changed, and then back up or not, that four-game suspension thing. You know, you alluded to, I mean, let's not forget, especially in that social media realm, how legendary some of his binges and things were. He is the reason that people are asking these questions, fair or not, of one Baker Mayfield.
And that's not fair. That is absolutely not fair. Because Baker Mayfield, you know, is his own man, and Baker Mayfield might be fiery, and Baker Mayfield
right.
played, you know, in the same conference, and, well, originally. Texas A&M, of course, then went to the SEC.
Right. But, yeah.
But you know, originally from the same conference, same style of football. Excuse me. And Baker Mayfield is brash and cocky and confident and everything else. But it's unfair to assume that he's going to have these kinds of problems the way Johnny Manziel did. But you're right. Here's the real thing that I think, you know, it's just ironic, I suppose. And I feel really, really badly for the dude. And I also wonder if Vince McMahon is going to want to pull this back in a little bit. But there's another NFL or another football league that is going to be starting in a year and a half, and they're going to be drafting and you know, putting rosters together probably sometime by the end of this year, I would imagine. If they want to play in 2020, they're playing in 2020, correct?
Right.
They have
yes.
2 years. Yeah, they said they want to give them 2 years to build this. 2 years. So between this year and next year, they're going to be building rosters, and Vince McMahon is going to be looking for names and is going to be looking for popular guys that people want to see play the game. Johnny Manziel, I would think, if he doesn't convince an NFL team to bring him in, would be a perfect name. You know, it's funny, McMahon came out there at his press conference when he introduced the new XFL that's going to be reborn in 2020. He said, we will not take any players who have any kinds of criminal backgrounds. And the fact that Johnny Manziel didn't just have substance issues, but he has that domestic violence charge that you just talked about, or domestic assault charge that you just talked about, means that he probably, unless Vince McMahon alters that or changes that, he wouldn't be able to be employed. McMahon said that we want not just the best players that are available, we want the best people. That's who the American people want to root for. And that could have been, you know, the rebirth of a young guy like Johnny Manziel's career at a place like that. They would need his star power. You know, McMahon said, we would love for a Tim Tebow to come and play with us. Well, Tim Tebow, of course, is about as clean as, you know, as anybody can be, and is virtuous and is well-respected and so on and so forth.
And that could happen with the 2020 start. That's two more seasons to figure out if the baseball thing's going to work or not.
Exactly, and I think that'll be decided by the end of this season, to be quite honest with you.
I agree
with that.
Might
be ready for Tim Tebow to move on to his next challenge, whatever that might be. But Manziel, those kinds of names, my gosh. Guys like Manziel, look, I was just as disappointed and disgusted in the way Johnny Manziel's tenure in Cleveland went and ended as anybody, because he was just another of the long list of quarterbacks who failed there. But I loved watching him play, and I loved watching him play in college. And I can tell you this, if they're trying to get people to turn on a TV set, if the headline, you know, says on the new XFL network, which I think they were talking about possibly doing, is getting their own network rather than buying, you know, the time from the mainstream networks. But if the headline was, you know, the Los Angeles, I don't know, whatever, Earthquakes against the, you know, Toledo, why not? What the hell? Let's put an XFL team in Toledo. The Toledo what? What are we going to call them? Kush?
Oh, man.
The Toledo Borders. We're close to the border of the state line. Whatever. And Johnny Manziel leads the Earthquakes into Toledo. Guess what, man? I am turning that son of a gun on. Of course, if the game was in Toledo, I'd be watching it. I'd be there. But I'm watching it. I want to see Johnny Manziel play football. He's exciting. The way he runs, the way he throws, the way he extends plays, the way he does all those things that he does when plays break down, that's when his skills take over. I'd watch the hell out of that. And it would be great for him and great for the league, but unfortunately that probably never happened.
Yeah, and what's interesting, Ed, I believe we mentioned this ever so briefly the day we were talking about this, the day after the announcement of the XFL rebirth, that rule that Vince McMahon says he wants to put in is probably going to be the first one to go, because on some level you're going to need names on some level as well.
Exactly.
And you're right, Manziel would be a name, but he would violate technically Vince McMahon's own rule that he's trying to put in.
Yeah.
That's why I remember thinking that very day, and that was, a couple weeks ago now, and I still remember thinking, yeah, that if there's one rule Vince McMahon's going to probably go back on, it'll be that one.
That one never – correct me if I'm wrong, but that domestic violence or domestic assault charge or whatever never resulted in a conviction, did it?
You know, I can't remember. I don't think it did, but let me triple-check.
It's okay. It's just a rhetorical question more than anything, because that would be his out clause, McMahon's. Not that he was charged – but convicted. If you're convicted, you can't come and play with us. But just if you're charged, you can come and play with us.
And, yeah, this is from back in November, this past November, that misdemeanor assault charge was dismissed.
Okay, so that would be the green light there. But I thought he said even if you have had so much as a DUI, you can't play, but that would still be a conviction on a DUI.
Right.
So there's probably some room there, and I hope that works out that way. I really do, because guys like that should play. And I would also say this. I feel moderately hypocritical, moderately, about my stand on this, about, you know, hoping that Manziel gets to play in the NFL, hoping that he is sincere and that he's not just playing GMs with the, hey, I didn't know I was bipolar and that was causing my depression, and when my depression happened, it made me drink, and it was my own only way of dealing with my depression and my sadness, blah, blah, blah. If it's not just playing them, if he's real and sincere, I want to see him succeed, and I want to see him get another shot, because I enjoy watching him play. The moderate hypocrisy here in my own stand is, I have said many times about Josh Gordon, also of the Browns, he's had enough chances. To me, you know, how many different times can he be suspended and then eventually banned from the league without, you know, and actually have it stick? Dude has had so many opportunities at the college level and at the pro level to clean himself up, and he can't put down the weed, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, enough is enough. I have drawn a line in the sand with Josh Gordon. Is it hypocritical for me to say I want to see Johnny Manziel get another chance? I hope not. I want guys on the field that I can look to and say I like the guy, not just the uniform he's wearing. But I might be. Some might say that's hypocritical. I guess the only thing I'm looking at is, you know, I didn't say this after Gordon's second or third suspension or problem. I probably said it after his sixth or his seventh, in the same way that people used to about Steve Howe, the pitcher for the Yankees. You know, when he had six or seven different drug suspensions. Eventually, enough is enough, and somebody has worn out their welcome. I don't know if Manziel is there or not. I hope I'm not being hypocritical by suggesting that he's probably not there to that point yet. But
I don't think you're being fully hypocritical, because when it comes to Josh Gordon and the concept of an athlete getting second chances, Josh Gordon's in his own universe almost with as many chances as he's got. Oh, sure, you know, Manziel has made some screw-ups, but he hasn't gotten anywhere near the amount of second chances, and most other guys haven't the way Gordon has. I think they're a little bit two different levels here.
Well, that's because Gordon took his.
Right.
Josh Gordon has already had his second chance, and he has had 20 other guys' second chances as well, all applied to him. So he's pretty much out of them, I think, But it's interesting. I'll be interested to see if anybody buys the Manziel story and the, you know, whether or not he's sincere about his bipolar disorder and depression and all of those things that caused his problems. But if the NFL doesn't, I really, really hope that the XFL is able to pull guys like that in. There are a number of guys I can name for you right now that are either out of football, that would be great for that league starting up in 2 years, or guys who are in the league right now but I expect will be out of football by that time and who should have opportunities to play. You cannot just have a league of backup boring quarterbacks
right.
who didn't make it in the NFL and now they're starters in the XFL. You need players with cachet. You need players with names, with reputations that are identifiable.
Vince McMahon's not trying winners. To create a minor league here.
Exactly.
He doesn't do anything minor.
Right. You cannot make it a minor league. It has to be a different league, a separate league. This needs to be the way. And the other part is he needs to open up the wallet and lure himself. If he can get a few, he's only got eight teams. You only need eight starters, quarterbacks. If you can get Manziel and Tebow on two of them, now you're down to six. You already have star power, for better or worse, at two of those quarterback positions. Open up the vault and get one top college quarterback 2 years from now. Just get one of them. Just pull one of them in away from the NFL. Outbid the NFL for one guy. And you're on your way to having a possibility of success. It's exactly what the XFL did when they pulled Herschel Walker and they pulled Jim Kelly from the NFL draft. They took them from college. They were drafted by the NFL. They did not go. They chose to sign with the bigger dollars that the USFL offered. You pull a couple of names like that in, you know, and again, I know Baker Mayfield's coming out this year, but a Baker Mayfield-type guy, and you have star power at those positions, watch. People will want to see it. And I hope that guys like Manziel would be part of that.
And Manziel, I think that's still the best option for Johnny Manziel, because whether you believe him or not, to me, is almost irrelevant to what I'm going to say here, which is my gut tells me there isn't going to be a GM who's willing to take that risk in the NFL with Manziel and his possible sincerity or not in this one. That's
until,
just my hunch guess. I don't think any NFL phone is ringing.
Until he starts playing someplace else, and they say, damn, he looks like he still has some skills.
That's the place else would have to be the XFL.
Whether it's CFL or XFL or something like that, that is the kind of thing that will open up their eyes and say, huh, I wonder if it is worth bringing him around. You know, look at what Doug Flutie did after going to the CFL.
That's right.
Doug Flutie came back, and by the way, not a terrible comparison there. 5'10" Doug Flutie, 6-foot-tall Johnny Manziel, maybe 5'11", depending on who you believe. You know, if you succeed in one of those kinds of leagues and do some things, maybe you get that chance to have your career in your 30s, for example, in the National Football League. All right, enough about Johnny Manziel. It's just an interesting story of either redemption or very sincere fakery and some really, really good storytelling from a guy trying to desperately get his way back into the league. All right, let me get a quick time out of here. Hey, Jim.
Yes?
You still have those golf show passes?
I have a couple of them left.
I got a pair of tickets, or Jim does, in his hand right now. Toledo Golf Show, February 16th through the 18th. That's this coming weekend if you're keeping score at home. At Tam O'Shanter, if you'd like to go to the golf show, I've got a pair for caller number 5. We'll make it a par 5 this time. 866-240-1065. Those tickets will be yours. And then on the other side of giving you those tickets and hearing a bottom of the hour local sports center. We're going to talk college basketball Buckeye style, and that is extraordinary style as the Buckeyes keep on rolling. Paul Keels, the voice of Ohio State basketball, joins us next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
4:45 rolling on, final segment on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket this afternoon. Congratulations to John Mauck. John Mauck of Sylvania was the winner of our golf show tickets. I've got one more pair of those that we'll be giving away sometime during tomorrow's show. Remember, the golf show is coming up at Tam O'Shanter this weekend, the 16th through the 18th. All right, I want to shift gears now and get to college basketball. You just heard Jim Cushlin mention it in the Sports Center. The NCAA selection committee has come out with kind of like their, I don't know, their early sneak peek, if you will, as you know, as far as what they're thinking with respect to seeding in the NCAA tournament. Kind of the way the College Football Playoff Committee came out the last several weeks of the regular season with their look at it. And right now, the committee, if they were starting the tournament right now, they would have Purdue with a one seed. And you just heard Jim Cushman mention Michigan State would be a three seed. The Buckeyes, who currently sit on top of the Big Ten standings at 13-1 over Michigan State and Purdue 12-2, the Buckeyes would only be a four seed. That doesn't seem right, especially with the Buckeyes coming off of a tremendous win at Lafayette over the Boilermakers. And joining us now to talk about that and more is the voice of the Buckeyes, Mr. Paul Keels. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm good, Bob. They've succeeded. They've got us talking about it, right?
That's their goal, right? And we are suckers. We fall for it every time we do it, all during the college football season when they put those rankings out and they get us going. Let's save that for a second, Paul. Let's talk about the wins, first of all. Just an unbelievable season that just continues to get better for the Bucks. They follow up the loss to Penn State on the last second shot with four wins, Indiana, Illinois, number three, Purdue, and then Iowa. And by my count, they've won 12 out of 13 and 17 out of their last 19. Paul, this was not supposed to happen this season, not in the first year of the new coach, not with the young team, not with the team in transition. How in the world are we sitting here with looking at right now the number eight team, according to the AP, the number eight team in the country?
A good, clean living, Bob. That's got to be it. it's a combination probably of all of the things that we've talked about. I think you look at certainly the biggest factor is Kata Bates-Diop being healthy and having a player of the year type of year. And the thing that maybe we haven't talked about as much is kind of how that has affected Jayshon Tate, meaning he's not had to score as much as they asked him to last year. He's been able to be more of a facilitator. Obviously, the massive improvement of C.J. Jackson, the surprising contributions from Andrew Dockage. And then if you really just telescope on that Purdue game the other night, they're down 14 points, and you start getting offense from people that you haven't gotten it from like that all year. Andre Wesson gives you some long-range shooting. Musa Diallo, who had not scored in 9 games, gives you 3 3-pointers. Micah Potter has started being a little more consistent with some of the serviceable minutes as a backup. And this team just seems to be playing very well together. Yes, they have a great individual player, and maybe more than one, but they play together as a team. And the other thing, Bob, that maybe we haven't talked about as much is just what they've been able to do defensively as a team to be able to really get their opponents out of their rhythm.
Paul Keels joining us. This is going to be a little bit out of left field when you talk about Kata Bates-Diop. What kind of a pro prospect do you think he is? I know he's worried about, as he should be, you know, these last four regular season games going into the Big Ten tournament and trying to compete in the NCAA tournament for a championship, and that's fantastic. But I'm just looking at his 20-9 numbers when you say he's a potential player of the year, and I agree with you. He really is. I mean, he's averaging 19.9. I rounded it to 20, so sue me. 20-9, shooting 51% from the floor, 81% from the foul line. The guy is a very talented guy. How do you rate his pro prospects at, what is he, 6'7", about 230 pounds?
Yeah, 6'7", but with a wingspan of almost a 7-footer. I think the other thing you have to throw in there, Bob, is blocking shots and the shots that he affects and changes because of his presence. I would think he'd be looked at as a good pro prospect because of, he's a pretty good ball handler for his size as well. He's been a team-oriented guy in his career leading up to this before he's become the go-to player. He doesn't force his offense to come to him, and I think you've seen some of the games where he got slow starts but then really kind of got things rolling. So I would think, you know, for whatever my say-so's worth, I would think he would be looked at as a good pro prospect. And, you know, I think that ties into the fact that we're probably watching him for the last year at Ohio State.
That you led into it, yeah. That's why I was asking, both for his sake, what kind of a prospect, and for Coach Holtman's sake, is he going to lose him? Do you think he comes back for his senior year? So you think that this kind of a junior year is enough for him to go out there and be a, you know, prospectively a top pick, a top level pick of the draft?
I would think so, Bob, for a number of reasons. You know, he's graduated. He did graduate back in December. So he's accomplished that goal. I think the fact that you look at it, and anybody who's played at this kind of talent level and then has lost a season due to injury, as Cade did last year, he played in only 9 games. You know, your mind has to think about those kind of things as well, you would imagine. So, I would think that it's a reasonable outlook that Cade probably would be gone after this year, because who knows what next year would bring. And, you know, when you're playing the way he is, if this team continues to have good team success, If he just stays consistent with what he's been doing, then it's hard not to blame a guy for going pro at that point.
Oh, it really is. I totally agree and totally understand that. Just wanted to find out what you thought his, if you had heard the way he's rated by prospectively by NBA scouts, to see
if the
coach would have him.
I have not. Yeah, I have not heard, but I, you know, just like you, I would think that he'd be looked at, you know, as a first. I don't know about lottery, but as a first round draft pick.
I would not intentionally look past the win over Iowa, but it's not the one that I'm focused on. It is that Purdue victory, an amazing win at Lafayette. We talked about it last week leading up to it, about what a challenge it would be, and to go in there and beat Purdue, number 3, playing the way, well, I shouldn't say playing the way they were. Purdue had shown some vulnerability, I think, in previous games, as you pointed out, the Michigan game that they had a very tight win, and some other ones as well. But what an incredible win. What a confidence booster, and most importantly, it gave them the outright lead in the Big Ten Conference.
Well, and the thing that got scary about that, Purdue in the first half had not been shooting from outside very well. They caught fire in the second half. In the first half, we saw just what kind of a difficult matchup Isaac Haas is, and it basically took Caleb Wesson out of the game. But then when Chris Holtman and his staff went small, and they had Andre Wesson at 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", maybe, guarding Haas, it kind of worked to where it did the opposite. It pulled Haas away from the basket. And even Matt Painter, in an interview we were fortunate to do before the game, he had talked about how his team had not been rebounding as well as he had hoped they would. And Ohio State was able to take advantage of rebounding. They were able to force turnovers. You know, the play at the end of the game obviously speaks for itself, but I think it was one of those where everybody, pretty much everybody who got on the floor had a key part in helping Ohio State win that game. And I know you don't want to focus on the Iowa game, but I will say this in significance to all of it, Bob. A big emotional win over Purdue, coming home with a sellout crowd, all of the things that could possibly set you up to be a little laissez-faire about it, this team mentally was very sharp and very much on point when it came to playing Iowa Saturday, because they knew that this was an Iowa team that could play better than the one they had beaten in January on the road.
Let's talk about Penn State on Thursday, Paul Keels. Obviously, that's the one team to break that run. They have won 12 out of the last 13. It was only a late shot by Penn State that gave the Nittany Lions a win there. Revenge on the minds of the Buckeyes on Thursday? That's a typical cliched question, obviously. But basically, how are they focusing and preparing for Penn State and the challenge they bring at Penn State?
You know, I don't know if revenge would be the word that would come up, but I think they certainly know what kind of talent Penn State has. That's a team that I think they've won like 3 in a row and 5 out of 7 or something crazy like that. They're playing with pros on their roster. Tony Carr, who hit the game winner, you know, is a guy that, depending on how things go, he might leave after sophomore year this year. Mike Watkins, their center, is a guy that does nothing but make plays around the basket. Josh Reeves, who had come back from suspension for that game against Ohio State, is a guy that makes things happen defensively. Penn State has got maybe one of the best collections of athletes in the Big Ten. I don't know if you'd say they're the best team as far as playing together, but they've got guys, you know, the young players coming off the bench, and Nazir Bostic, who helped them win last night at Illinois, Shep Garner, who was just deadly on fire in the first game in Columbus as far as an outside shooter. So Penn State's a dangerous team. They're playing for an NCAA tournament opportunity. They know they're in the running for it. I think, what are they, at 18 or 19 wins right now. It's the best team that Pat Chambers has had since he's been there. Now, obviously, Ohio State's very mindful of having played them and lost them. Here's the other thing to keep in mind, Bob. No matter how good Penn State is, they don't draw fans. They get very poor crowds there in State College in a big arena. So it won't be a hostile environment like Purdue was or like Michigan State would be or something like that. But this is an Ohio State team that has shown great focus when it comes to moving from one game, leaving it behind, win or lose, and getting ready for the next one.
Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, joining us. Paul, real quick on the seeding thing, like we talked about, they gave us a little sneak peek, and they said the Buckeyes would be a four seed, despite being ahead in the Big Ten of Purdue and Michigan State and beating Purdue just last week. What are your thoughts on the way they're being viewed right now?
You know, I think that's one of those things, Bob, that it would take care of itself in the next few weeks if Ohio State wins the regular season title, if they get to the Big Ten championship game. And I think what Purdue and Michigan State do is maybe going to have more to say about that, because I think if you look at those two teams on the hoof, especially Purdue, you know, they physically and from just a basketball aspect look like a Final Four team with size, with outside shooting, with some depth. Michigan State, with some of their depth and with what Bridges can do. So I think, you know, there's probably some, you know, eye talent, type of view when it comes to those kind of things and looking at everything over the course of the whole season. But I think Ohio State is in a position now, you know, and if you gain some comfortability with them being at a four seed, they now have an opportunity to improve that, because three of the next four are on the road. If they're able to, again, get Michigan State or Penn State, they would, you know, if the standings stay the way they are, they wouldn't have to play them both in the Big Ten tournament. But I think if they were able to play one of them and beat them, and as well as dodge Penn State in the regular season, possibly Nebraska in their first game of the Big Ten tournament, who's playing real well and playing for their postseason last, then I think that will help Ohio State stock tremendously and will help take care of that.
Paul Keels, of course, is the voice of the Buckeye basketball team, but also the football team, and Jim Cushman wants to hit you on that one. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, we had the National Signing Day back on Wednesday, Paul, and I know a lot of these guys were inked, if you will, beforehand in that early signing thing that we all had in December, but give us the lowdown on some of the guys they were able to get specifically this past week, and obviously the offensive lineman, the five-star recruit from Florida, he was the big one.
He was the big one. And again, Jim, because of basketball, and I think I told you earlier in the week, I hadn't really been all that focused on that. But I know that getting that offensive lineman was crucial. Also, the defensive lineman they got from the junior college level, and the name escapes me at the moment. And he's a guy that I think they really think can be a good add to get into that mix and that rotation with what they've been doing for years on the defensive line with playing five, six, seven, and sometimes eight guys. So I think that's, you know, those are the two big gets right now. That really are going to help them. It'll be interesting when we get to spring ball, and spring practice will be starting soon, just to see these guys, you know, start to get indoctrinated and everything there. So it was very good. I think the interesting thing now, you know, their biggest recruit was keeping Greg Schiano, and then seeing who they're going to get to replace Kerry Combs in the defensive backfield on the coaching staff. It sounds like the rumors are Tabor Johnson, who had been a DB's coach on Jim Tressel's staff, and as an Ohio native, Tabor Johnson might be the guy that would become that 10th assistant and fill the spot for Kerry Combs. So those are the two big recruiting things that I think people are still kind of watching right now. But getting Greg Schiano to stay was very huge.
That's a big part. I know we talked about that a little bit last week because there had been talk of him going and leaving, and then that was unsubstantiated. And obviously, as it turns out, he is sticking around to work at least one more year with Urban and the Buckeyes. Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes. Great stuff, Paul. Thanks so much. Have a great time at State College later on this week, and we'll chat with you again next week.
Sounds good. Take care, fellas.
Paul Keels wrapping it up for us. You heard the music. You know what that means, don't you? We're done. Time for Drive Time. Stay where you are. That's coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.